Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle. This is The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. And today we are delighted to be speaking with Samuel Gillis Hogan, a man who knows a thing or two about the fairy folk and how to summon them and get them to do things. Sam, thank you so much for coming on The Schwepp to share your very, very exciting research.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've recently finished a PhD thesis, the title of which includes the words Fairies in English Ritual Magic and Occult Philosophy, 1400 to 1700. And I sort of fancy myself someone who knows a little bit about grimoires and West European magical tradition and so on and so forth. I did not know that there actually was this body of texts. So before we get into lots of interesting questions about the good folk, I wonder if you could tell me what your sort of corpus that you studied is. Give us a picture of the range of manuscripts you've looked at, what you can do with them, all that stuff.
Sure. I actually faced exactly the same sort of questions when I started this research. Initially, the sort of genesis of this project was a conversation I was having with my then master's supervisor, Frank Clausen, about various topics I was interested in looking into. And over the course of the conversation, we wandered and started talking about a novel that both of us really loved, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the plot of which is sort of instigated by summoning a fairy. He, Frank Clausen, that is, mentioned that there were some fairy summoning spells that he had sort of stumbled upon during his research, and pointed me to a section of his book, The Transformations of Magic, and I went there and I read that, and I realized that a manuscript had been recently published as The Book of Oberon by Daniel Harms, and he had written an article or two about fairy summoning rituals, and these little scraps here and there, two or three articles, two or three chapters, and they were each sort of looking at individual rituals or a couple of copies of them that were appearing. The Book of Oberon had multiple fairy summoning rituals in it. And I got really excited. And so when I proposed it to my PhD supervisors, they said, well, you know, yes, it's good that you have a few, but, you know, you may not be able to find them. And if so, we can sort of use other things like court records and depictions of fairies. But I was really determined. So I went to the archives and followed up on those which had been mentioned by other academics and followed some likely leads. And in the end, I looked at 19 manuscripts that contained collectively 71 copies of about 27 distinct fairy summoning rituals that have survived.
Boom.
And since my PhD was finished, I have found and been directed to some more manuscripts, so definitely still material out there to be found.
Mm, but you hit the mother lode with this one, really.
I think so.
The next step, of course, and it's going to be, this conversation progresses, it's going to be clear that you're not just looking at these manuscripts, but you're asking a lot of really interesting questions about them. And one of those questions is, what exactly is a fairy? We'll get to that in a second. Once you've come up with what you mean by a fairy and you've looked at all the manuscripts in England, you might want to look at what there is in Iceland or what there is in other parts of Europe or what there is in China that might be fairy stuff. You know, once they wouldn't call it fairy, they would call it whatever the Chinese word is. Or maybe look at magic to do with jinns and stuff like that in the Islamicate tradition and do comparative work. But that's just to whet people's appetite. Let's start with an easy question then, having introduced our text. What is a fairy?
So,
because we haven't talked about fairies on
fairy is as elusive as the entity the word is referring to.
Right, yeah. It wouldn't be right otherwise. It's a bit like when you talk about magic and that you try to come with some rigorous definition and, you know, you lose the magic in doing that. Haha. So, but you have been thinking about fairies a lot and thinking about people thinking about fairies a lot and thinking about people summoning fairies to do things for them. So what is a fairy? Mm-hmm. What do your texts that you've worked on think fairies are? Or what do they think they do if they don't say what they are? What do they do?
So this is what I find actually really interesting. It's exactly what you're talking about right now. Debate amongst the people who were writing these texts. I even found one where the magician was essentially listing several different explanations for what these things are that were circulating at the time. And he's sort of sequentially going through and saying, and this one's rubbish because of this, and this can't be the right answer because of that.
Oh, that's so cool.
So there was an awareness that there's a diversity of explanations for what these things are, but still a recognition that those things exist. From the perspective, the sort of orthodox Christian medieval perspective was that anything that's referring to itself as a fairy is just a demon that's trying to trick people by appealing to sort of popular ideas. But the people who were engaging in this magic were not always conceptualizing them that way. And one indicator of this is that oftentimes fairy summoning spells, in fact, almost exclusively, fairy summoning spells circulated in manuscripts that were filled with ritual magic, often explicitly invoking and summoning demons. And yet, even in that context, fairies are invoked specifically. As far as I was concerned in going in and doing this research, I wanted to be led by the sources as much as I could as far as how I'm defining things, or at least what I'm including when I say this is a fairy summoning ritual.
Right.
So I started essentially by saying, okay, this is, say, Oberon is the name of a fairy from medieval romance, the French romance, Huon de Bordeaux, where it's sort of Auberon, the fairy king, and that's likely coming actually from the Elberich, the king of the elves from Germanic heroic literature.
Right, okay.
So that name had this history as being a fairy entity. And so when a summoning spell summoned Oberon, whether or not it specifically describes him as a fairy or a spirit, people would recognize, oh, that's the entity from these medieval romances. And sometimes he is specifically referred to as a fairy and the king of the fairies, and sometimes simply as a spirit. And in both cases, they were included. And then from there, sometimes there would be features, tropes, essentially, that would find their way into the rituals from literary contexts. There's one ritual to summon three fairies, and, you know, they appear as a set of three. You choose the most beautiful out of the three. You have to set a table for them with bread and milk and all these other sort of tropes and features that are evocative of these sort of otherworldly, fairy, wondrous entities from literature. And sort of those elements found their way. And so the earliest fairy summoning rituals are essentially demon summoning spells with the names and tropes of the fairies of medieval romance inserted into them.
Okay, so the mechanics of the spells are familiar from spiritual magic of the medieval period more generally.
Yes.
Okay, now why do you want to summon a fairy? What's the fairy going to do for you? I imagine multiple things depending on the text, but what's the sort of range of things you can get a fairy to do?
It does, you're right, there is a range. They were often summoned to bring rings of invisibility, to find Earth, which they were understood to be the guardians of, to be the sort of bound into a familiar spirit relationship with the magician. And that's something that is quite frequent as well. They were also invoked to teach healing and the occult properties of plants and herbs and gemstones, essentially natural magic.
Okay, so they can instruct you.
Yes. And in medicine as well, they seem to be able to teach that to the sublunary world, the world of the elements in which we live.
Right. All of these things are found in other magical contexts, both angelic, demonic, and, third category. But one thing that's really interesting about European fairy lore is, and this is something you address, which in your thesis, it's a really big theoretical point that you have come up with. But traditionally, let's say, fairies live in another world. They have a world, fairyland. It's typically sort of accessed through landmark, or sometimes accessed through physical landmarks. Like they live under that hill. Or, there's a gate, or there's a lake, and if you go there, there's a boat, and then you get in the boat, and you'll go across, and then you're in fairyland. Time can move differently there, all that stuff. And what it isn't, usually anyway, is heaven or hell. It's its own sort of other world. And that, to me, is really, really interesting, because not every culture has that. Like a parallel world that sometimes intersects with ours, but it's not an eschatological world. It's not like where you go when you die. It's not where dead people go. It's not really where gods live. It's this place where these other non-human people live.
Yes, absolutely. And I would consider that to be characteristic of medieval fairies. From what I've found, and sort of what I would argue, is that this is primarily drawing from classical conceptions of Hades, perhaps being syncretized with the Germanic ideas of the realm of the elves in sort of Norse myth. But certainly the classical influence is very evident. In one romance, Sir Orfeo, it's essentially a retelling of the Orpheus myth in the medieval period, and Pluto and Persephone are replaced in it by the fairy king and fairy queen, and they live in fairyland, which is a land that's lit only by the treasures that are filling it and surrounded by a wall of mutilated corpses.
Charming.
Yes, I know.
This kind of otherworld, it's really fascinating to me. I wonder if there's, the earliest reference to an other world, I think, in the Western canon is Lucan talking about the Celts, and they believe in another world, Orbis Alius, I think he calls it. And so maybe there, despite all the nonsense that's been blathered about Celts and Celticness and fairies and the link between the two over the centuries, maybe there is some kind of like just native Celtic otherworld belief that plays into this, at least some of this stuff as well. Not everyone who has fairy beliefs obviously is remotely Celtic in any way, but certainly in these isles, there's a bit of that. I wonder...
But if I could sort of...
Yeah, go on.
Can I actually say something to that Please. Point? Gerald of Wales actually reported a story in his journey through Wales of talking to an elderly priest who claimed as a small child to have been stolen away by pygmy-sized people into their land under the earth. They had no religion but worshipped truth alone, and both men and women had golden hair down to their shoulders. And when he was expelled from that realm, he remembered bits of their language, which seems to be sort of a Gaelic-Latin hybrid. So there is sort of precedence for, this syncretization of perhaps Germanic and classical and Celtic ideas swirling around in that milieu. One of the reasons that I tend to maybe distance my fairies is because in many ways the ideas that I'm looking at seem to have spawned on the continent. more than in an insular context. And it seems like the word fairy was brought into England and then used by the English to describe the otherworldly beings of Celtic mythology, rather than the idea of like fairies originating in a Celtic context and then spreading, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Does it come from the French fae, or whatever the root of that word is?
Yeah, my understanding is that the most recent explanation for its etymology is that it comes from the French fae, which likely comes from the Latin fata, referring to the three fates, because of the close association between fairies and the ability to foretell or shape the future.
Right. Yeah, when I said that the fairy otherworld is not an eschatological world, that's not quite right, is it? It's definitely got elements of, often elements of an underworld. It's often very dwarvish, you know, but it's also often very kind of like deathly. There's often some death involved.
Yeah, there's a question sometimes as to like when humans who have died are then referred to as fairies or appear in retinues of fairies or in fairy worlds, the question is sort of arises of, is this that their soul is being trapped and become part of it?
Right.
Or is it that person didn't really die, they were stolen away, and now they're trapped there? You know, there's a little bit of ambiguity, but there is a connection to death, if not a intended, approved destination of the soul.
That, right. You know, there's weirdly, I hate to lower the tone, but weirdly, in a lot of UFO accounts, people see their dead, like, granddads and stuff. There's like a whole body of eschatological UFO material where people encountered the dead in UFO encounter experiences, which might or might not indicate that.
That's interesting.
UFO and fairy are in some way the same thing, as has been posited many times.
It's not my it's not my field exactly, but I think some folklorists have proposed that.
Yeah, and some UFO people as well. Jacques Vallée, very famously, was, you know, he did a kind of trawl for, starting from UFO lore, he went back through the records and tried to find earlier UFO encounters, right? And so lots of angel visions and fairies end up being brought under the same umbrella as this weird phenomenon that has these things in common. You know, like the time, weird slowing down and speeding up of time sometimes shows up in fairy stories and in UFO accounts. Various other similarities. The tricksiness of it too, the inability to really figure out what these things are, you know, it seems to be common to both. I do want to talk about your sort of theoretical findings, but before that, I wonder if you could just delight us with one or two other amazing things you found in your texts, like amazing workings or stories or just cool rituals or whatever that just blew your mind when you were looking at these manuscripts.
Well, one which really struck me just due to how dramatic it was a multi-step ritual in which you need to produce an ointment with which to see fairies, but its goal is to bind a fairy to you as a familiar, and as part of it you go above the fairy king and queen to invoke the power of the fairy empress Delphoria, and over the course of 7 days kill seven small animals and birds and take their fat and do one process with it and take their blood and do another process with it and produce this ointment and then bury it in a fairy mound for a series of days and then do this ritual to sort of perfect the ointment, which then you can apply to your eyes and gain vision of the fairies so you can bind one to you. And there are similar rituals, but none as complex and sanguine as that one. I think one of the things that emphasizes to me is, well, you know, the modern world often has this very saccharine conceptualization of the twee fairy. This is not what was being summoned by these people. They were, I mean, oftentimes conceptualized and depicted as being human-sized or at the smallest, a, like, child-sized entity. Mm. And there was definitely a danger. As I said, the earliest fairy summoning rituals, the operations are essentially the same as a demon summoning spell, with all of the precautions and bindings so that the magician is protected when the entity is summoned.
Mm. Speaking of human-sized, and actually reminding me of the UFO thing that I brought up, I don't blame you for that, but tell us, if you wouldn't mind, before we move on, about the Green Children of Woolpit, because this is amazing. And it's just one of those things that people should know about if they don't know about it already.
Yeah, that's a really unusual incident. There are actually two different chroniclers from the time period who make reference to the incident. The story goes that two young children were discovered in Woolpit, England, who were green from head to toe and spoke a language that no one could understand. And they were brought to a local noble household where he took them in and fed them, but they refused to eat anything except for raw beans. Eventually, the two sickened and died, but the girl survived. And after eating human food for a while, they lost their green coloration. Mm. And as she grew to be a normal young woman, except she had a propensity for promiscuousness. Mm. And I think that that might be another little indicator that what's being sold here is a fairy, as fairies were very closely associated with libidinousness throughout the medieval period. Richard Firth Greene, we should actually often read the word incubus in medieval texts as fairy, as wow. There is no Latin word for a fairy, and this may have been a cognate that was being sold. When she learned English, the girl said that they came from a realm that was full of twilight opposed to the sun, and everything was green there, well, all the people and livestock, and following her father's herd, she found her way through a crevice of the earth out into the light of the world and couldn't find their way back again. This is drawing upon, or at least echoing, contemporary ideas of fairies and wondrous beings and where they come from and how they work.
And it's just a weird reversal of the straying into fairyland motif, where a human ends up accidentally wandering into their world. And then, you know, God help him if he eats the food and that sort of thing, right? He's going to be stuck there potentially. And it's like the reverse, like a fairy yes. got lost, or a couple fairies, and wandered into the human world. And I guess maybe because they were children, they didn't, you know, they didn't have all their fairy savoir-faire about them yet, and they just got stuck. They didn't know how to get back.
No, it's a very interesting account. In fact, there's been an interesting book written on this recently by John Clark called The Green Children of Woolpit, which has been published by Exeter's New Approaches to Legends, Folklore, and Popular Belief.
Fantastic. That's a great series that people should check out. It just came under my radar. I didn't even know what was going on. So the Green Children of Woolpit, this isn't a ritual of fairy summoning, but it's a weirdly factual account of some fairy-like entities who wandered into a village and then just lived there for a while. Very, very odd, very interesting. It certainly enriches our understanding of medieval fairy culture, I guess you could say. Now, the title of your thesis is Fairies in English Ritual Magic and Occult Philosophy. So let's bring the occult philosophy into it. What did you find here? What occult philosophers were interested in dealing with fairies? And what was your sort of overarching finding regarding this stuff?
The most influential occult philosophers in the English context were Henry Cornelius Agrippa and Paracelsus. And they actually articulated what these entities were. So to start with Paracelsus, he essentially argues that there are four types of wondrous being that dwell within the four elements of the natural world. He argued that those who dwelt in the water were the Undine, or nymphs. Those who dwelt in the earth were the gnomes, and those who dwelt in the sylphs. Those who dwelt in fire, he called the salamanders, but he's not referring to the lizard. They were, like, you know, humanoid entities. And also, one thing that I should note is that sylphs will generally bring to most people's mind, I think, this airy, fairy entity, feminine, gliding on the breeze. Yeah. And this is emphatically not what here. Think about more like a woodwode or a Bigfoot type of entity, sort of a hairy, shaggy thing in the wood.
Right.
Sylph likely comes from Sylvan, or of the woods.
Right.
And for Paracelsus, these four varieties of elemental being were not spirits. Sometimes he calls them sort of half-men or half-spirits, but he makes clear they seem like spirits because they can do a lot of the things that spirits can do. They can go invisible and perform all sorts of other miraculous feats, but they're not spirits to Paracelsus because they have bodies. And he says that on the other side of things, they're not humans because even though they have bodies and the faculty of reason, they lack a soul. And so they cannot be humans because of their lack of soul. No Christ ever came to them. They are without salvation. And so he argues that they are actually animals because they have a body but not a soul, as he understood animals to do. Yeah. And it's very clear that what Paracelsus is doing is retconning and reinterpreting the entities of medieval romance, who are often identified as fairies, like Melusine. He specifically refers to her and says, oh, all of those things are actually these beings, and the elemental beings live for a very, very long time, but when they die utterly and return to the elements. Paracelsus actually uses this to explain why female, well, all of them really, but particularly he talks about the female undines of the water as being so promiscuous with humans. He says it's because they're trying to entrap humans into marriage, because by partaking in the sacrament of marriage, they're imbued with a soul and can survive the death of their bodies, which is this very interesting sort of reimagining of why they have this promiscuous association in the medieval period.
It also raises a
other world.
Sorry, can I just ask, can I just interject and say that it raises the interesting kind of ethical theological point that it would surely be a good deed for humans, therefore, to marry these elemental beings, right? Because you're like, you're saving their soul. It would be like a form of Christian outreach, like missionary work almost, but probably a lot more fun than normal missionary
work. That's an interesting idea.
surely well, giving an entity a soul.
A little bit of a warning.
Oh, okay.
It's true. It's true. When you think about it, I mean, that seems more important in many ways than saving a soul through conversion. But he gives the warning because he notes that when a human displeases a husband or wife of these elemental beings, they just flee and return back into their element where humans can't get to them.
Right.
But you're still married. And he notes that it's been known that when humans remarry after losing such a wife or husband, the elemental being will appear and bring down its vengeance upon them. So it's a like, if you do this, make sure you're a very faithful partner.
Right. Yeah. And hope that the elemental beings don't have a kind of fairy-like
fickleness.
That's exactly it. That they're not just gonna get all in a huff for no reason. And what did I do, honey? Oh shit, she went back to the water element. I'm screwed. Okay.
What's really interesting here is that he destroys the fairy otherworld, because what he argues is that through their marvelous powers, they are able to produce illusions that make people think that they've been taken to some wondrous other world.
Right.
But even though that's what the human is perceiving, they're really just trapped in some grotto under a hill. And so it's sort of recognizes the reality of these entities, but makes he draws them out of fairy and places them very firmly within our world alone.
Right. He's arguably doing a kind of scientific reductionist explanation of fairies, right? Based on the assumptions of his time.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Sort of reconciling them with a more naturalistic worldview.
Right. And what does Agrippa do with the fairies?
Agrippa has essentially the opposite explanation in some ways from Paracelsus. Agrippa essentially provides a fundamentally Neoplatonic model of the universe, wherein you have God, the super celestial sort of angelic entities in the next rung below him, then the celestial spirits. But then there are the spirits who minister to the earth, who come in four varieties based off of the various elements. He spends particular attention on the ones connected to the waters, which take female form, echoing Paracelsus, and those who are connected to the earth, who take male form, also echoing Paracelsus. Of course, in the next rung below them, you have the infernal spirits of the underworld below. In setting up this model, Agrippa is saying that there is a type of spirit who, as he says, minister to the earth, which are not angelic, are not planetary, and are not demonic. He sometimes refers to them as the third order of spirit. And they are unusual because once they sort of enter into the world, they weave bodies for themselves made from the element that they are connected to. And so they are tangible. Paracelsus says that they, you know, only have bodies and no spirit. For Agrippa, they are spirits that happen to be able to make bodies for themselves and interact in the world. But even within the Agrippian system, once again, he has framed them as entities who are a part of this world, intimately and fundamentally connected to various natural features. And Agrippa says, oh, and by the way, Melusine was one of the wondrous folk from Norse mythology, and various, you know, daemons and nymphs and fauns and all the rest of them were these entities. Essentially, what Agrippa's doing is saying all of these wondrous beings and gods and noumena from the classical culture and Norse mythology and presumably others, because he ends that list with et alia, are not actually demons, which is sort of the Augustinian explanation for them. He says that they are a third order spirit. They are good to those who are good to them and wicked to those who are wicked to them. And they exist within the spheres of the elements in the earth and minister to it, which is interestingly vague.
Yeah. Like, what do they do exactly? But, you know, the term Neoplatonic is tossed around a lot, but that is just... that could be Porphyry or Proclus for that matter, or Iamblichus. Change the names, of course, for these entities, but the idea that there are daimones that deal with the sublunary world and have a kind of function in the whole grand scheme of things and are neither good nor evil, but can go either way is present from Porphyry onward in late antique Platonism. So,
yeah, and I actually have argued that Agrippa, drawing from other sources as well, was drawing from the Platonist philosopher Apuleius, his Didao Socrates. Mm-hmm. He has a discussion of daemons, which at times Agrippa is almost quoting word for word, although he does not sort of give a citation.
Yeah. So is it the case that the occult philosophy, as it were, put fairies on the respectable table to some degree of the sort of legitimized fairies by systematizing them? What was the sort of effect of this approach? Obviously, the fairy, the slippery and liminal fairy otherworld has been sort of defanged and hung out to dry with both of these guys. Does that sort of domesticate the fairies, or does it just give them a different kind of weirdness?
Well, it makes them a thing that is more knowable.
Right. You understand
some
them
of
now.
Those early fairy, yeah, some of those earlier fairy summoning rituals I was referring to will actually have stipulations such as, once you've summoned it, don't ask it whether it is a woman or a spirit, or else essentially the binding will break and it will leave, which shows how there is this discomfort and, like, we don't know what these things are. But once these explanations have been written by these occult philosophers in Germany, you can quite quickly see influence from them starting to shape the summoning rituals in England, even older summoning rituals that predate this occult philosophy become elaborated and augmented with elements drawn from it. And that's even before the English translations of these occult philosophical works, 1600s, when you see an explosion of this fusion of the occult philosophy with the ritual magic used to summon fairies, and you get some very, very unique and bizarre results where essentially the fairies that are being summoned by the rituals might still be going by the names of the fairies of medieval romance, but have been completely reconceptualized from being the otherworldly entities to being entities that are ubiquitous, connected to essentially every natural feature you can imagine.
So this is all happening within a Christian context, a Christian intellectual context. That's clear from what you've said so far. And so one might say, well, that's not a very Christian way of approaching the world. Christians, you know, all think like St. Augustine. There's heaven and hell and this world. That's it. anything out of the ordinary, best to just assume it's a demon and leave it alone. And then you have this thought world in which there's this completely liminal other category that can partake of the angelic, can partake of the satanic, can just be people with weird motives and green skin. Very slippery. How does that work with Christianity? And this is, I think, some of the most interesting conclusions you came to in your thesis. You know, what do we make of this Christian fairy belief, in which both this occult philosophy we've been talking about and all the summoning rituals both find their home within this Christian worldview?
Yeah. So this is actually what I think is being done by the occult philosophers of the Renaissance, Agrippa and Paracelsus. They are reconciling these sort of decontextualized pigeon beliefs, essentially, in these wondrous folk, which are really produced. I mean, the idea of a fairy is a medieval product. Its roots are from these polytheist traditions, but the fusion of them into a category of a fairy, even if it's a nebulous one, is a medieval. What the occult philosophers are doing are taking these things that don't really fit with any orthodox theology or understanding of the natural world, and certainly not orthodox, definitely idiosyncratically, but they are trying to reconcile it with a fundamentally Christian worldview. Right. You know, within the Agrippian model, they are that sort of Neoplatonic extension within the rung of the earth. For Paracelsus, he argued that God made these elemental beings essentially guard the treasures of the earth, which is to say the natural resources of the earth, so that they would only be revealed to humans in bits and pieces in one place and then another, so that they would last humans until Judgment Day. essentially for Paracelsus, they are divinely appointed ecological resource managers for humanity, to use a modern parlance. So even though, you know, orthodox theology might not have a place for these entities, even if it's idiosyncratic, the system of thought, the way that they understood the world to work was fundamentally Christian, even if it was unusually so.
So in your thesis, you bring up the notion of animism in this context, the context of the occult philosophical meets magical fairy lore thing that happened in the thought world of Europe. And where do you see the animism? Is it in the traditions, the unlettered fairy traditions that we sort of see in filtering into romances and in folk practices and so on? Or is it in the occult philosophical stylings? Or is it in both? Are these both animistic? And if so, you know, how? What's animistic about them?
Yes, that is essentially the contention of my dissertation, that in the Renaissance occult philosophy and early modern ritual magic that we see the articulation for the first time of a learned Christian animism. This is not to say that there were not animist elements to previous traditions that are actually being elaborated and maybe more fully articulated in this material, at least fully articulated in writing in this material.
Right. Yeah.
So this is not to say that it was not an element that precedes it. But what I think is really unique is that you have, and this is really starting in a way in Paracelsus, but certainly in Agrippa, later in the spell books themselves, you actually get lists where it will say, like, fairies, fields, nymphs, fountains, fauns, thickets, etc. Different specific regions and locations that these entities were connected to. And the spells start to stipulate things like, you need to go to where the entity you're trying to summon dwells and do the spell in that location, which sort of once again emphasizes this connection to place. I argue that it's being articulated, at the very least, in this learned occult philosophical and ritual magic practitioning context, whether or not there were echoes and roots of it that precede it.
I wonder if indeed that isn't a kind of scientific take, which is, as you say, really well described as a learned animism, a scientific take on beliefs that were much more widespread among rank and file Christians, most of whom were illiterate, right? Like, the fairies are real. We deal with them on a day-to-day basis. My buddy's seen one, or there's, you know, a woman in our town who's a changeling or whatever. Like, there's all these, you know, things in day-to-day life of everyone that has something to do with the fairies. And they just kind of see the landscape as inhabited by fairies. And that is another. So what I'm getting at is, like, not only some of the traditional names of fairies, some of the traditional, you know, famous fairies from magic and folklore find their way into this learned synthesis of the occult philosophers, but also just the animism. Do you know what I mean? Like, are they bringing animism out of the unlettered Christianity, where there's tons of it, and in a way allowing it to enter into learned Christianity, finding a way to bring animism from the people to the big brains?
Well, I mean, certainly throughout the medieval period, you know, people were living learned and unlearned alike in a inspirited world, whether you are talking about, you know, the demons constantly at play, or even amongst the more learned, the planetary spirits and all of their influence.
So there's
definitely precedent for a world that is inspirited. One of the things that I do discuss in the dissertation is how, you know, medieval fairies, yes, the entries, the gate points, are parts of the natural environment, but they are exiting out of it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Opposed to what we see arising in this Renaissance and early modern context, where they are fundamentally connected to these natural places. One of the avenues of future research I intend to look into is exactly this. How much of an earlier precedent is there really? I mean, for example, in the story of Hurla, who was within the account, a Breton king who was invited to the wedding of a fawn and pygmy person in a palace lit only by lamps. And when they go into his realm in the hill, you know, they pass the night, and so many years have gone by that his kingdom is gone, the Anglo-Saxons have conquered, and they're sort of trapped wandering because whenever they step down from their horses, all of the intervening years fall upon them and they disintegrate into dust.
Right.
So very clearly a fairy or proto-fairy story. Mm. But the question is that actually another world? Was Paracelsus actually articulating what the general idea had always been, that these other worlds are illusions? I mean, the very fact that it doesn't have a sun, nor does the account given by Gerald of Wales, nor does the account of the children of Woolpit,
exactly.
Oftentimes not having a normal sun or sky. It's like, are these literally just underground? In that case, even these other fairy other worlds can be read, whether illusory or literally under the earth. So yes, there may well be earlier precedent that we're getting echoes of in these literary texts that are being explicitly articulated in the Renaissance. And that is definitely an area that I actually hope to explore further.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. Keep us in touch with that, because that research to me is fascinating. And, you know, it's rare that you get a firsthand account of a visit to the other world as interesting as the green children of Woolpit, or the green daughter of Woolpit, I guess, the one who survives, talking about the place she came from. Because we get angels telling, you know, in visionary tales, telling about what heaven is like, I guess. And there have been lots of tours of hell and accounts of what hell is like. But I don't know, there's something special about that testimony to me. It's not like some saint who is wrapped up to heaven and saw some amazing stuff and came back to tell you about it. It's like the entire population of this medieval village who are just fully aware that that one woman, the town slut, is actually not a human at all. She's from another world.
Right. Yeah, no, these fascinating, as you say, the prosaicness of it in some way, or the priest that Gerald came by who
yeah.
wept at the memory of this world that he couldn't have access to anymore. I mean, oftentimes we associate fairies with grandeur and kings and knights because a lot of our stories are coming out of that more elaborate literary romantic tradition. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love the corpus, because as like people may well have believed in fairies, even though they are the subject of literature, you know, like they
right.
understood King Arthur to be a historical person, even though there were lots of stories about King Arthur.
Yeah.
So like, it's not as though they didn't believe in them, but you know, literary examples are literary. They are meant to tell a good story and can be elaborated by creativity. Whereas the fairy summoning rituals certainly are practical how-to guides of how to invoke these things. The occult philosophy is trying to fit them into a believable conciliation of these entities with a fundamentally Christian world and contemporary natural philosophical ideas. These are being written by people who understand these entities to be real things that can be invoked as sources of power and knowledge, and with whom one can establish an ongoing relationship as a familiar spirit. One of the interesting things that I observed is that it's not infrequent to find fairy summoning rituals bound quite early in collections of ritual magic, almost as though it was a place to start than an out-and-out demon might be.
Right. Or maybe if in the case where you're getting a fairy on side to serve you as a kind of magical servitor, get the fairy on side mm-hmm. before you mess with the demons. That could be one possible scenario.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. To act as sort of an ongoing tutor, because they were understood to have mastery of magic. And it was important to be able to bind them. There's a spell to summon the seven fairy sisters to guide you to treasure, but there is an exorcism of the seven fairy sisters from the treasure is buried. There's the sense that these entities protect and guard treasures that are hidden in the earth. Mm-hmm. So if you expel it, you free the treasure from their control, but you can summon them to help guide you to treasure. Similarly, they were often closely associated with illness. The seven fairy sisters started their life as a medieval charm to banish the seven sister fevers. And there is even an exorcism of the seven sister fairies that seems to be to remove illness from a person. But you can summon fairies to teach you medicine and healing magic. So there's a sense that, like, they, you know, they control the things that are within the elemental world, whether it be natural resources of the earth, whether it be health. And when left to their own devices, they are often antithetical to human will. But when bound by magic, they can be very helpful in those ways as well.
Sam, thank you so much for sharing a little sliver of this amazing research. This corpus you have sort of unearthed. I mean, lots of these texts have been dealt with piecemeal by in different contexts, in Shakespearean literary studies, in a little bit in the study of magic here and there. But no one's ever just done a let's find all the English fairy manuscripts and see what they say work before. So you've done a great service just from doing that. The theoretical ideas you bring to bear on it, bringing the philosophy together with the more practical addressative stuff, has borne such great fruit in your scholarship. So much appreciated for coming on the podcast and sharing your findings with our listeners. People should check out your thesis. Is it available online?
Yes, it is available online through the University of Exeter thesis database and on academia.com.
Perfect. So check it out. Don't wait for the book, even though the book is coming, I'm sure. Samuel Gillis Hogan, stay esoteric. Actually, let me rephrase that. Samuel Gillis Hogan, be like the true ontological status of fairies and stay esoteric.
Thank you so much.